Hello, welcome to Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schleinkofer. Today we rejoin part two of our interview with Jonathan Hollerman, author of Survival Theory, A Preparedness Guide. And also we have Todd DeVoe with EM Weekly as our guest host. So let's get on with our show.
Absolutely. You don't even have to look that far back. I mean, just take a look at Venezuela today. You know, just watch the news. Their grocery stores are empty and people are starving right now.
They're eating zoo animals.
And the government's failing.
Right. Yeah, and that's we are not the culture. We are not the people that we were. You know, and some, you know, the progressive left said, "Oh, we've progressed so far past this." Not what you count for moral relativism, because the problem with moral relativism today, in other words, everybody's their own god, and everybody, there is no right or wrong. You could be a, well, all right. Trying to steer clear politics here. So the problem with that scenario is that only works in a very disciplined, lawful society, like police-driven society. You take that mentality that most people have today, where people are, well, we're all generally good, and you know my decisions are mine, and then you put them in a lawless society, a post-collapse society where there is no law and order, and everybody gets to make their own rules. I mean, we're essentially the Vikings at that point. I mean, it's the guy with the biggest club that's going to eat the most food, and that's where you end up. And we got to be careful here, because I talk about this stuff all the time, and a lot of people, even in the emergency management industry, even in the prepper community, they tune out. When you fear, you know, they say it's fear-mongering. You're just trying to scare people. And, you know, that's a big thing with even the government, the people trying to get the grid hardened today. They don't go this dark, right? They don't talk about the things underneath the covers, because it'll freak people out. People be like, ugh. And they just tune out and they walk away. That's a problem. That's a major problem, because if you want to wrap yourself in the nice warm blanket of a false sense of security, you're not helping yourself. You have to face the truth, and you have to face the reality of what. There's another prepper fiction author. He was given an interview, and you know, there's a lot of things that I read. I'm just like, man, this guy has no clue. I mean, some of the stuff these people write about, I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, that's the idea that 5 days after collapse, you're going to still be able to go to the store and get food. and you know, people are going to stand in line. There's going to be a police officer there that lets you go in and buys up to $50. Like, that's insane.
No.
First of all, 5 days after the collapse, when there's rioting and looting, that police officer ain't standing there.
He's going to be taking care of his family.
Yeah, that grocery store manager that makes maybe $12 an hour, that has no idea, that doesn't have any corporate stock in that store. If you think they're showing up to work on day five, To make sure nobody steals food from a store they have no vested interest. It's just like, anyways. But that's true, because again, a lot of people don't take that same information. Like, okay, well, society will fall apart. They don't realize that the government and the military will fall apart too. 99, I have documents on my website, showing 99% of the U.S. military installations are wholly reliant on civilian electric grid. There is a report trying to get small nuclear reactors for each base, so they can be independent of the civilian power grid. And we're talking about technology that would be here for the next 15 years. And they're not paying for it. It's not going to happen. But right now, all people don't know. I mean, outside of our, you know, nuclear missiles in Omaha and Cheyenne Mountain and the, you know, secret stuff, everything is relying on civilian electric grid. You lose a civilian electric grid, our military, the report tells Congress, I mean, there's a report to Congress that says, after 24 hours, we will not be able to function. We will not be able to respond to societal unrest. We will not be able to, the military can't function without electricity either. That's the craziness. And so you sit there like, well, you know, they'll feed them. There's only so many MREs.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. In Hollywood, you always see those box trucks coming down and they're passed out MREs out of the back of it. Man, if you believe that's going to happen, I got OSHA for profit here, so I'm going to tell you.
Yeah.
Like, if any military MREs or government MREs, they're going to the soldiers, right? But those are going to run out really fast, too. Those are going to run out in a matter of weeks, maybe months. And you have all these young kids I was one of them. You know, better.
Yeah.
And all these young kids, they're on a base, which is semi-secure, and they're hearing reports a weekend of literally fish burning to the ground, like just on fire, rioting, losing. How many of those kids are going to stay on base? They're going to have the perimeter fences of the military installations that are looking like Swiss cheese, with all the kids going home to check on mom and dad, or their girlfriend Susie, or, I mean, this idea that, you know, because a lot of the continuity of government, continuity of military, I've read a lot of these plans, the DHS plans, they all rely on effective leadership, communication, and most importantly, feeding. You take these kids, you don't feed them.
They're
and
gone.
Then they have no idea what their parents, what's happened with their parents, their wife, or their kids. They're gone. Same thing with hospitals. You know, hospitals, they've got, you know, I think whatever they mandated, 48 hours of backup power, diesel backup.
Yeah, 48 hours. Correct.
That's about what's going to be. And I think most doctors and nurses are required, was it 19 hours to stay on 19 hours past their shift, to, or 18 hours or something?
Well, here's the thing.
Once they go home, Jonathan, they're never coming back. They too, the police officers that are supposed to take up the next shift, they're never going in. They're staying home to protect their families.
Right. Right.
Jonathan, we a contingency that we have specifically for disasters, and talk about earthquakes again, that's a grid down situation.
Yes.
We're looking at a 40-50% reduction in our force due to the fact that people can't get here, number one, if it's an earthquake, or two, they have to check their family first, and then they'll come to work. You know, and then the other thing, too, is we say...
I would challenge you on that, brother. I would. And even in a case of an earthquake or something, if, you know, you look at Hurricane... We've all seen the pictures of Hurricane Katrina, what happened to people down there.
Oh,
we've
yeah.
all seen pictures of the rioting and looting. You're talking about the L.A. riots. I think, you know, if you only lose 40% of your force, like you mentioned, they have to go home and check on their family first, do you think they're going to leave them? If there's rioting and looting in the streets and people are... rioting or whatever. I mean, do you think your emergency managers, I'm just trying to be realistic here. Do you think they're going to, like, but I got to go into work. I don't see it happening personally. Denigrating anybody. I'm not denigrating police, firefighters, hospital workers, military. They're humans. I think a lot of people, especially the government, federal government and the military, they look at their soldiers and their troops and their people in their organization as pawn pieces and numbers. Move around the board, fix this, plug this hole, do this, do that. Not realizing that those are human individuals, human emotions, and human psychology. And when something really bad happens, I'm not talking about a minor thing, but if something bad happens, I don't think you can rely on very many of those people showing up. Anyway, sorry. That's where I would disagree.
I think the reason why FEMA doesn't address these serious grid down situations is because if they did, they would own it. They would own every aspect of it, and they don't want to own it. The federal government doesn't want to admit it, and so they don't want to own it. And so it is up to every individual, family, neighborhood, and community to prepare for emergencies. And
100%, let me jump in. You are 100% correct. DHS has been talking about putting a EMP, you know, grid continuity, you know, government plan together for 4 years. And about every 2 years they release a paper saying, and we are now going to officially start working on the plan. It's basically what it says. There's no plan. So, I have always said, because people, you know, will be like, oh, well, what's the government going to do? What are they going to do? And I try and tell people, they can't. It's absolutely impossible to feed 350 million Americans with no electricity. You cannot do it. I don't care who's running the show. I don't care who's running the show. You can't do it logistically. You can't. You just can't. So what's going to happen is these government officials are going to end up in, you know, some underground cavern with, you know, with their families and food, and they're going to ride it out till 90% of us are dead. Then they're going to walk back out and be like, hey, let's start rebuilding.
Yeah, that's let's start rebuilding. This, yeah, this is yeah, now my kingdom.
they've all gained 15 pounds, and we're all like looking like Schindler's List.
Yeah,
know? Yeah. We're going to be like, yeah, buddy. Yeah, don't trust the fat guy in a scenario like that. Anyways,
no.
So, No, you're right. So I tell people all the time, in a grid down scenario, it is a society and it's a culture killer. Don't expect the government to come and help you at all. And that's where I think the civil defense, emergency management, a lot of that is about management. It's about having that continuity of government where you can talk to the guy above you, they can talk to the guy above them, you can get stuff, move resources around, make things work for your community and your organization. But if there's no communication, there's no food infrastructure, there's no diesel for your backup generators ever going to become. At some point in that scenario, you've got to be like, there's no point. And I've done this. So
right.
I actually met with the mayor who was prior in the civil defense emergency management. I'm not going to say what name of the town because he paid for me on his own dime.
Right.
It didn't come out of the county budget. But sat down and we spent 2 days game planning. 2 full days. He was like, I read 1 second after. It freaked me out. You know, I want my, and we're talking about a town of less than 1,000 people, little village in the mountains, right?
Right.
He's like, I want that to be us. I want 1 second after to be us. And I told him, I said, well, first of all, I said, I love William Forsen. It's probably one of my favorite books, 1 second after, in this genre, right?
Right.
Amazing. There's a 900 pound elephant in the room because there's a big time gap there from like week 3 and jumps to like the following spring.
Yeah.
They never explained how they fed 500 people through the winter. They just didn't. And the thing is the average human eats 2,000 pounds of food a year, a metric ton. In other words, that town of, what was it, Black Mountain?
Yeah, Black Mountain, North Carolina.
That town, that mayor, I forget the head guy who was running the show, not the mayor, it was whatever his name was. He would have to bring in 2 metric tons, essentially a dump truck of food. He would have to supply a dump truck of food to that town throughout the entire winter. No prior planning, no anything. You would have to supply a dump truck full of food to your town every day till you were able to get your next spring where you were able to grow your crops, not even when you start planting, but when they, you know, harvest time. And that's the problem. And that's where we came to. There were things he could organize. There were farmers. There was a lot of beef industry in the area. But at the end of the day, it's that initial gap from day one of class till day at least 60 when your carrots and tomatoes start growing, assuming the class or the grid down cave in the spring where you immediately start growing. You've got 60 days of food you got to supply your people for. And that's what we came down to, that there's no way to maintain order, because I told him, I said, here's the deal. You can, you know, keep your police force fed. You can keep your emergency responders, your hospital people fed. But at the end of the day, if you've got an entire town of starving people, they're going to be beating each other to death for, you know, a blade of grass. You're not going to be able to maintain order. And the only way to do that would be to basically become a warlord and have, cut people's hands off for stealing a loaf of bread type stuff. And I don't even know how you do that. I'm not going to ever write a book, How to Be the Best, you know, Most Ethical Warlord. I don't know how to wrap my brain around that. So my solution is you can only prepare for yourself and your family, right?
Right.
And all my survival retreat planning and probably 50% of my clients had existing survival retreats. And I can tell you right now, the number one problem. So the number two problem is location. Most people build a survival retreat or they just, it's like, I show up, I'm like, I can see your cabin from the road. You know, that's a problem. You know, that's a big problem.
Yeah.
Other than location, you know, be too close to a big city or so on and so forth. The number one problem I see is food. Okay? So even in the prepping community, even in this industry, I'm thinking all my clients, maybe 2, have as much food as they should. Almost every single client, I have a questionnaire, you know, they fill it out before we start working together.
Right.
And I ask them how much long-term food they have. I can almost guarantee you, 99% of the time, it's about 40% of the amount of food they think they have. Because almost all of them have bought a year's worth of long, you know, freeze-dried food from Wise for a family of 4. I'm like, Yeah, have you ever looked at the calorie count of that?
Yeah, now, exactly.
Huge. They sell that based on serving sizes, and they're banking on 800 calories a day. A food at 200 of those calories are a sugary orange drink.
Yeah.
So,
you know, one of the things that I've learned in my studies is you have to be able to survive through two growing seasons before you can really say that you're on the grow, because there's a lot of trial and error that happens the first year and even some in the second, but those two will be the practice sessions, and once you get to that third growing season, then you should be doing well. You agree?
Yeah. I agree. So I say at a minimum, you need a full 1 year food supply. That's basic, bare minimum for most of my clients. Again, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, most of my clients, I have the money to do this. I'm not saying that, you know, you're single. Well, if you're single, you should be on four, because you don't need that much food. But so you need to have at least a year, because like you said, you have to make it through the first growing season. You will learn a lot through the first growing season. I think a lot of people are going to grow about a fifth to a tenth of the food they need to make through the next winter. So if you need some of that food that summer and that fall, you know, and that'll offset some of your year's worth of food storage. And I'm kind of hoping that a 1 year food supply mixed in with food from the following growth season will get you through the following winter as well. Because coming back to gardening, I live in a town like 800 people. It's a huge farming community. It's all farmers, and a lot of people do garden here. But I'm like, okay, so what happens when you get, you know, powdery mildew on your squash plants? You run down to the hardware store or the nursery, and you get some spray to spray them. What happens when you get cedar rust on your trees? You go, you know, what happens when you get Japanese beetles? You go and you buy beetle bags, or, you know, you might grow food today, but you've never lived off it. It's never been life or death growing that food. And it's always been like, yeah, my tomato plants didn't really grow this year. And in a class scenario, it's like, yeah, oh, you died, you know.
Yeah.
You didn't grow the food you need to grow. Well, it's not. Well, we'll go to the supermarket and buy it. So this idea that, and I don't know if you garden, sir, but gardening,
it's hard work.
It's not like kindergarten where you put the seed in the styrofoam cup and you put it in a little water and then you get like a forest shoot.
Yeah.
That's not hard to get the shoot. And to keep it alive for the summer was hard, especially when you don't have, you know, watering systems. There's so many variables to grow your own food. And even the farmers today, the farmers in this country, most of them, one, they have modern tractors that may or may not work. They may not have the gas to power it for very long.
Right.
They may not have the gas or diesel to run that tractor. A lot of the implements, the mass-scale farming that's done today isn't going to, it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
And then the other side of that is every farmer, I grew up on a farm, every farmer I know buys their seed for planting at springtime.
Right. Yeah.
Every year, right before planting, you know, they don't have, like, you know, seed vaults in their barns somewhere where they're storing up seed for 5 years.
Right.
So, you know, depending on the time frame, you've got, you know, if the collapse hits that 1 week in between when they bought their seed and they put it in the ground, we might have a shot. But if it's outside of that 1 week, as far as mass feeding people,
Well, it was great. I wish we had more time. I would like to get into the final chapter of your book, where you talk about the spiritual aspects of being prepared. But we'll have to save that for another time. So, Jonathan Hollerman, it's been a pleasure, and I'm again a big fan of yours, and I hope we can get you back again on our show sometime in the near future.
I'd love to come back on. If anybody wants to follow me on social media, you can find me on Instagram at GriddownPrepper, on Facebook at Jonathan Hollerman. My website is griddownconsulting.com, and I've got all the information on my books and my biography, and I got a small store there and some other information, as well as I have the first four chapters of my book, Survival Theory, on my website, all the research section, where you can go through there, and as you read through, you can click on the link, and you actually see the supporting documents I talked about in my book, so the last thing would be my everybody. Jump on Amazon, go out, buy my book. called Survival Theory, A Preparedness Guide, How to Survive the End of the World on a Budget. I also have a fictional series called EMP, Equipping Modern Patriots. And, you know, I'm going to give a free plug for my for this gentleman, Selko Petrovich. Again, I don't know him from Adam, never spoken to him. But I'm only halfway through his book, but it is required reading for anybody in this industry. It's called The Dark Secrets of SHTF Survival by Selko Petrovich. So, hey, I really appreciate you having me on today, Preston. And thanks for letting me plug myself at the end there. And I'll be happy to come back.
Great. Well, thank you.
That was Jonathan Hollerman, author of Survival Theory, A Preparedness Guide, available on Amazon. I really appreciate you guys listening to the show today. As always, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you until next time. Thank you. Goodbye.